There's a great phrase by the beat poet Philip Whalen to describe what they were trying to do, or what he was trying to do in relationship to. He called it continuous nerve music. And there's this sort of sense that there's this ongoing stream, which has a sort of shape to it. And if you can kind of practice with it, you can begin in the same way that people who are jazz musicians, for instance, and who may do a lot of practice, you know, on their own before a performance in terms of playing lots of different parts of music. But then once the music starts, that the all the elements of the practice sort of start coming together. So you have this sort of sense of people basically using material that maybe at one point would have been in notebooks. It's very notational a lot of the time for New York School poets. There's a sort of sense of things that have been noticed quickly in the way that you get them in notebooks. But here they're being kind of collaged together. They're just being brought together partly by the force of the personality of the person. Okay? The sensibility of that person is enough, they believe, to hold it all together. Okay? And you, what you start getting is, you also get these like slight. It's very talky. It's very kind of, it's glib in a way. You know, it's light. Okay, there's a kind of sociability to it, a sense of friendliness. But there's also something that's being registered at certain moments that's a little darker and not disturbed in a deep way. Just kind of unsure in some, so those lines, but it is good to be several floors up in the dead of the night, wondering whether you are any good or not, and the only decision you can make is that you did it. And there's something a little dark, the shading there, is it's a very, very slight thing, you know, but I think that sort of there's a little bit of doubt, you know, in the whole enterprise, you know, right? It just kind of erupts. And it's not his job as a poet to make something out of that. To deal, it's not his job, for instance, to confront it. You know, it's just his job to sort of notate it as part of living, and not to exaggerate it, not to make it something melodramatic, something that it isn't actually in everyday life. Because the way we experience life, okay, seems more accurate in these poems, or these poems seem more accurate to the way we actually experience life in consciousness, which again was like one of the big projects of a certain part of American poetry in the 1950s. There's something that I, in this stanza that begins, as well as a number of other things, and then he goes on to talk about Allen and Peter. Allen is Allen Ginsberg, Peter is Peter Orlovsky, Joe is Joe Lesurre, Kenneth is Kenneth Koch, I've forgotten who Norman is. It's very easy for us now, at this point in time, to read that and just to kind of take it for granted. But that was not something that had been done in American poetry previous to this point. Okay? The idea that you would bring your friends up in this very casual way in the middle of this poem, it's kind of an aside, what it has to do with the poem as a whole. If you were a new critic looking at this poem in the 1950s, you might say, you know, this doesn't have anything to do with the actual theme of the poem. It doesn't seem overtly to have anything to do with that stuff. And this, it's sort of a, there's something really radical about, in the context of American society in the 1950s, which is a society that's increasingly organized for mass production, increasingly anonymous in a sense. The idea of blending in is an extremely paranoid, politically paranoid time. This is the time of the communist witch hunts, which, you know, one feels that, you know, people who are at all different or think differently are being searched out, you know, in order to be eliminated. And there's a sort of sense of that you should sort of be absorbed into the larger goals of society rather than an individual. And yet this is sort of insisting on the individual. It's insisting on friendship, you know, on intimacy. There's something incredibly intimate, you know, about him like just tossing off this aside, you know, and thinking you will be interested in that. You'll be interested in his friends. My friends are interesting. They are really interesting people. If you got to know them, you'd like them. And you get these sort of conflicting tonalities that they just kind of flicker there, as they do, I think, in consciousness. I wish I were reeling around Paris instead of reeling around New York. I wish I weren't reeling at all. It is spring. The ice is melted. The Ricard is being poured. We are all happy and young and toothless. It is the same as old age. So there's a sort of sense of contradictoriness a little bit. And there's a sort of sense of the only thing to do is simply continue. Is that simple? Yes, it is simple. There's some strange, it's all very light, but at the same time, there's a kind of resistance building up. And you feel, I think, again, those sort of anxieties that are just below the surface of the personality. They're not being made into a big deal in the poem. It's not the job of the poet to solve the problem. Okay, it's not a problem that needs to be solved. It's just part that anxiety, which is there in a sort of subtonal way, is something that we all experience in everyday life. And to make it into something that's a problem to be solved is false, okay, in this aesthetic. And, you know, in some way, that's the risk. You know, there is something heroic, you know, in making your friends the subject of the poem. There is something heroic in making your very personal, you know, sphere a kind of place that the reader can kind of enter into with pleasure. The assumption, you know, is a heroic assumption, I think. And when you look at the poem, at the ending of the poem, you see that there's no resolution to it. I mean, I love, there's a kind of cataloging, you know, of things that he has a kind of affection for or an interest in. And then, you know, you get this sort of penultimate line, René Char, Pierre Reverdy, Samuel Beckett. It is possible, isn't it? So it's kind of invoking, in some sense, his influences. And he says, I love Reverdy for saying yes, though I don't believe it. And this is sort of a sort of spiritual sadness, you know, I think, at the end of the poem. And it's about this undertow, you know, that you can hear in the passage that Don Draper recites. You know, there is something, you know, to be an individual, to be idiosyncratic in this culture, to be gay, you know, to be an artist, to be interested in the arts, you know, there's something lonely, you know, that's being registered in all of this. And a sort of adamancy, you know, that it has value. My life has value because it's my life. And there's something, I, for me, profoundly, you know, moving, I think, about all of that. I don't think we have a lot of time to talk about the Day Lady Died. I just, you know, would say that you know, if you look at it, it begins in sort of classic manner. It is 12:20 in New York, a Friday. You know, again, you're just having this sort of annotation of time. What's being mentioned consistently in almost every line in the first stanza is time, has to do with time, and the train times, you know, in a way are they are markers of a sort of commuter life, you know, and the people who are commuting are people who are commuting from the suburbs, and business people, men mostly, okay. And in a way, O'Hara is immediately kind of situating us, you know, in that world. It's all implicit, you know, it's all in the way that you would experience it, you know, in everyday life. It's not being made into a big deal. The whole project of the poem, which is an elegy for Billie Holiday, and I assume that most of you know it, is to memorialize Billie Holiday, but also to make a claim for her art, you know, in relation. So if you read the poem, and what you notice is that all of the art, most of the art that's being mentioned, is European. It's high art, a lot of it's high modernism. It's an art that O'Hara has an affection for. And in a way, there's a kind of implicit, you know, claim that's being made for Billie Holiday's singing, okay, a jazz singer, the only, okay, truly American art form, jazz, invented by African Americans. So in one way, this is a deeply political poem about this particular time. And it's a poem that builds up pressure in interesting ways because it resists talking about Billie Holiday directly. You don't hear about her, despite the title. The title should, you know, tell you that this is an elegy for Billie Holiday. Lady Day was Billie Holiday's nickname. So the title is a play on that, The Day Lady Died. You don't hear about her until the very last stanza, at which point the poem kind of turns back in time and space. It goes back in memory, you know, and it moves into this club. And all of the sort of pressure that's been built, because you have this expectation, you know, that he's going to start talking about Billie Holiday at some point, and he doesn't. Again, he's very much insisting on this sort of idea of I do this, I do that, and that's all the poem has to be about. All that pressure has been building up, and it all kind of flows into that final image of her singing in the room, you know, and while she whispered a song along the keyboard to Mal Waldron, and everyone and I stopped breathing. And this is one of those moments where the beautiful is being redefined totally and for all time, you know. I think if O'Hara were here, he'd be rolling on the floor laughing about a lot of this, because I don't think that that was exactly their conscious intention. You know, but again, there is a kind of bravery, it seems to me, in it. And this does seem not only to be a deeply personal poem, a deeply felt poem, but also a poem that has a kind of social mission, you know, attached to it in some sort of strange, oblique way. And it doesn't often enough, I think, kind of get recognized as such. I want to move on to Schuyler, because I think Schuyler's about something slightly different than O'Hara. The painters, the action painters, de Kooning, Pollock, and Klein, and Gustin, had a lot to teach the poets about compositional methods in the moment, how things could be joined together. And I think de Kooning in particular was an important figure for all of these people. So there's this little thing which I just want to read quickly, and then I'll play a recording of Schuyler reading February. But this is Edwin Denby talking about Willem de Kooning and his painting in the 1930s, and then what he was doing from that point on. He said, I often heard him say that he was beating his brains out about connecting a figure and a background. The basic connection he meant seemed to me a motion from inside them that they interchanged and continued throughout. So that sort of sense of like the motion of the background and the motion of the figure coming from inside them and then exchanging places. He insisted on it during those years, stroke by stroke, and gained a virtuoso's eye and hand. But he wanted everything in the picture out of equilibrium, except spontaneously all of it. That, to him, was one objective professional standard. That was form, the way the standard masterpieces had form, a miraculous force and weight of presence moving from all over the canvas at once. So I'm very interested in Schuyler's work, how things are brought together in a moment, kind of somewhat fragmented, okay? And they're kind of, what one feels is sort of the images vibrating off of each other. And that sort of sense that things are out of equilibrium. There's something, you know, sort of slightly off scale, off kilter about Schuyler's poems from this particular time period. Actually, almost all of them. They're quite beautiful often, but one can't quite figure out like what makes them beautiful. And in a sense, they're just a great example of this sort of art of improvisation and this art that really wants to locate itself in attention, which is this kind of a spiritual act in some sense. So this is Schuyler.
February. A chimney breathing a little smoke. The sun I can't see, making a bit of pink I can't quite see in the blue. The pink of five tulips at 5 p.m. on the day before March 1st. The green of the tulip stems and leaves, like something I can't remember, finding a jack in the pulpit a long time ago and far away. Why, it was December then, and the sun was on the sea, by the temples we'd gone to see. One green wave moved in the violet sea, like the UN building on big evenings, green and wet while the sky turns violet. A few almond trees and a few flowers, like a few snowflakes out of the blue looking pink in the light. A gray hush in which the boxy trucks roll up Second Avenue into the sky. They're just going over the hill. The green leaves of the tulips on my desk, like grass light on flesh, and a green copper steeple and streaks of cloud beginning to glow. I can't get over how it all works in together, like a woman who just came to her window and stands there filling it, jogging her baby in her arms. She's so far off. Is it the light that makes the baby pink? I can see the little fist and the rocking horse motion of her breast. It's getting grayer and gold and chilly. Two dog-sized lions face each other at the corners of a roof. It's the yellow dust inside the tulips. It's the shape of a tulip. It's the water in the drinking glass the tulips are in. It's a day like any other.
So, you know, one of the things that I think is going on in this poem, and that goes on throughout the New York School poet's work, is the sort of sense that anything or anyone, if they are observed in a non-judgmental way, can be a subject for poetry. That there's a certain kind of openness to anything that comes into your view or anything that you encounter during the day. If you are open to it, you can see, in some sense, the sublime in it. Okay. And the other thing that's being registered, of course, is that that thing is constantly vanishing. It's not stable. It moves away from you quickly, all right? And so this poem is sort of assembling a set of details that actually kind of record that in a particular moment. And it's very layered. And if you look at the beginning of it, the first, you know, quarter of it or so, it's very peculiar. Like there's a device that's being used. It's something close to what's called the via negativa, you know, the negative way. So which is the device you can use in a poem where you say, like there's a famous example by Marina Svetaeva, which she says, "I'm not homesick. I'm not thinking about, you know, the Russian language and it's da na 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 na. I am, you know, I don't care if I ever am back in Moscow again." I'm paraphrasing the poem terribly, so. You resist, you introduce something through resistance, through a kind of negative pressure, but it's there because you've actually had to mention it in the act of resisting it. So there's a tension. So you get that in this poem. A chimney breathing a little smoke, the sun I can't see making a bit of pink, I can't quite see in the blue. There's something that he's trying to register that is so... Schuyler's an enormously... I didn't get Schuyler myself for a long, long time. You know, I think it's really only in the last 5 years that I started understanding, you know, that the stuff is just so nuanced, you know. And also, you can hear how, in a sense, there's something really quiet about it. You could hear that in the reading. Schuyler I think, only read twice in his life. That recording is from like the late 80s, just before he died. But he was very nervous about reading, apparently. And there's something, though, there's a kind of, I mean, and you see this thing repeated, the pink of five tulips at 5 p.m. on the day before March 1st, the green of the tulip stems and leaves, like something I can't remember. And then he remembers it, finding a Jack in the pulpit a long time ago and far away. And so it goes on like that, you know, and he's basically kind of laying out through this sort of strange, resistant device. I mean, he's noticing an incredible number of things, but he's basically saying, I don't notice this, or I'm not sure what I'm seeing, if this is it exactly, or it reminds me of this thing. So he's constantly sort of distracted, too. So distractibility is actually a value in some odd way in a lot of New York School poetry. And then you get this sort of, you get to a certain place in the poem where you feel like something happens. There's a very odd little bit of idiom, American idiom. I can't get over how it all works in together. How it all works together would maybe be closer. It's sort of clunky, and intentionally so, I think. You know, and then that's the moment where the figure comes in of the woman. So that idea of de Kooning's, of like, how do you attach a figure to the background? Okay, and you can feel an enormous amount of energy, you know, and there's a spiritual energy in the amount of attention he's giving to this background, but there's also an energy in how it's all being brought together in this sort of strange, like somewhat decentered sort of way. You know, things don't flow. There's something hinky about it. It doesn't flow exactly. So it's out of equilibrium in exactly the way that Edwin Denby talks about de Kooning's paintings being. And then you get this figure. And there's something really plaintive in she's so far off. You know, again, it's that sort of sense of the aloneness of, you know, anybody's life, you know, but not melodramatic. He doesn't stay with it. He moves on. And then I love the way the poem ends. It's the yellow dust inside the tulips. It's the shape of a tulip. It's the water in the drinking glass the tulips are in. It's a day like any other. It's almost nothing. You can understand how, again, mainstream American poets would have looked at this. This poem was written in, I think, the late 1950s, and just said, what is this? It's nothing. It's not a poem. This is so not a poem, okay, that, you know, for most American poets at this time, this would not have been considered a poem. Okay, and the it is never really defined. It's totally floating in exactly the way that de Kooning oftentimes, or Denby talks about de Kooning. You know, the image, he says, in a de Kooning painting floats and expands. And you feel that expanse. I mean, I love the poem because it has a sort of spiritual expansiveness at the end, you know. And yet it's asserting something. It's just saying, it's completely ordinary, you know, but special. Not special, special.